Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org, and we're on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, January 18th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is Viet Thanh Nguyen. Viet's novel, The Sympathizer, is a New York Times bestseller and won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. It's won many other honors, including the Edgar Award for Best First Novel from the Mystery Writers of America. He's critic at large for the LA Times and has written for the New York Times, Time, The Guardian, The Atlantic, and other venues. He's here today to primarily talk about two of his other books, Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, which is the critical bookend to a creative project whose fictional bookend is The Sympathizer. He's also here to talk about a short story collection, The Refugees, forthcoming in a couple of weeks from Grove Press. Hi, Viet.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you. Great to have you with us. Before we go on to your new books, we have to say a few words about The Sympathizer, of course. And I guess mostly I'm wondering if you were surprised with its success.
Well, yes, obviously. I mean, it was a very pleasant surprise, but I don't think anyone can anticipate that a novel will do as well as that. So I'm obviously quite happy about it.
What were your expectations when you were writing it? And I imagine it's a big book, and I imagine it took a long time.
It actually didn't take very long to write. It took a couple of years to write compared to The Refugees, which took 17 years to write and 3 more years to see publication. And I think my expectations in writing The Sympathizer were pretty low because, in writing The Refugees, I was aiming for a larger audience. And ironically, in The Sympathizer, I was writing just for myself. And I thought, I hope I can find a very small niche audience who will respond to this book as deeply as I felt while I was writing it.
Now, Nothing Ever Dies came out a little while after The Sympathizer, and so I imagine it had been brewing for quite a while. It's a wonderful book. It has me still thinking about some of the things I read that I want to talk to you about in a minute. But were you writing it along sort of concurrently with The Sympathizer? How did that go?
Well, Nothing Ever Dies took me about 10 years to research, and I was writing several articles from that book while I was doing that. And at the same time, I was writing the short stories for The Refugees. And then I took a break for 2 years from 2011 to 2013 to write The Sympathizer. And after I was finished with that, we had 15 months before we were going to publish the novel, The Sympathizer. And so during that time period, I went back to Nothing Ever Dies, and I wrote the entire book from scratch during that 15-month period. So it was a book that sort of both preceded and came after The Sympathizer. All the research I did for Nothing Ever Dies deeply informs The Sympathizer. And everything that I learned about writing from The Sympathizer, I brought back into the actual writing of Nothing Ever Dies.
Okay. So take us into the process a little bit more of writing Nothing Ever Dies. When did you know you had a book as opposed to, say, a collection of essays or long-form articles?
Well, like I said, it took a decade to do the research for the book, and I wrote these various academic articles along the way to process ideas and, push me towards whatever the book was going to be. But during that entire decade, I had no idea what the actual book was going to be like. And as an academic, the easiest route would have been to collect the articles and, put an introduction and a conclusion on it and call it a book. But I was increasingly thinking of myself also as a writer, and that option just looked less and less attractive to me. I really wanted to write a book that would tell a story and that could possibly shift the conversation for the general public about how it is that we think about the Vietnam War and how we think about war and memory in general. And I knew that in order to do that, I really had to step back and think of the book as a whole. And I just didn't know how to do that until after I finished writing The Sympathizer. And then I realized I had the ability to then write this book as a story which could possibly appeal to someone else besides just an academic audience.
Mm-hmm. Of particular interest to me, there's quite a bit, but I can't talk about everything because we also want to talk about the refugees. But of particular interest was the chapter on victims and voices. And I think it's in that one that you talk about the deep literary tradition of Southeast Asia. And I am curious why that part of the world.
Well, you know, as a child growing up in San Jose, California, I was curious about my history, my past, what had brought me to the United States. So I was always thinking about, you know, what kind of books I should be reading that would inform me more about that history. And my limitation was that I could only read in English. And so through my teen years and then in college, I read everything I could find in English about Vietnam and about the Vietnam War. And, you know, part of the limitation of that was obviously that very little of this material was written about the Vietnamese point of view. And the best that I could find were translated books from Vietnamese fiction and poetry, for example. But then starting in the 1990s and into the 2000s, more and more Vietnamese Americans started to tell our own stories in English. And these books made an important intervention for me because in reading those books, first I could see that, you know, people were talking about the Vietnamese American experiences, but it also let me off the hook in the sense that I felt when I came to writing The Sympathizer, I no longer needed to tell the Vietnamese American experience.
Interesting. And then in the chapter on powerful memory, you talk about Michael Ondaatje's novel, The English Patient, and Kip, who is actually perhaps is he my favorite character in that book? I don't know. I love Kip, but he's Indian, and he has a realization about racism in the West and regarding Western technology and how it's used against non-Western people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Kip is also my favorite character in that book. I mean, it's a novel that is very beautiful and can be interpreted as a romantic love story and about, you know, the failures of European idealism and so on. But the Kip character introduces a completely different dimension into the novel, which is the history of European colonization, in this case, the British colonization of India. And Kip's role is as a colonial soldier who's brought from India to fight for the English in World War II. He's a colonized subject, and his job, his task, is to defuse explosives and bombs. A very dangerous job. And then one day, towards the end of the war, he hears about the bombing of Hiroshima, and he realizes that this nuclear bomb would never have been dropped on a non-white, on a white country, right? And that flash of the bomb is also the moment of his decolonization, his realization that he's working for a colonial army and a colonial government that would very easily have dropped the bomb on India if it needed to. And so I think he plays a crucial role in the novel because he prevents us from completely romanticizing Europe and the love story of the two other characters in the book.
Will you read a little bit from Nothing Ever Dies?
I'll read the opening paragraph of Nothing Ever Dies.
Okay.
I was born in Vietnam, but made in America. I count myself among those Vietnamese dismayed by America's deeds, but tempted to believe in its words. I also count myself among those Americans who often do not know what to make of Vietnam and want to know what to make of it. Americans, as well as many people the world over, tend to mistake Vietnam with the war named in its honor, or dishonor, as the case may be. This confusion has no doubt led to some of my own uncertainty about what it means to be a man with two countries, as well as the inheritor of two revolutions.
Thank you very much. That was Viet Thanh Nguyen reading from Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, published by Harvard University Press. What do you hope readers take away from this book?
Well, I hope that they take away a different understanding of the Vietnam War. I think the American perspective on the Vietnam War has come to dominate global memory through the power of American culture, such as Hollywood films, and the power of American discourse because of global American power. And so the irony of the Vietnam War is that even though the North Vietnamese or the Vietnamese communists won the war, that perspective has been completely overshadowed. And the book is not really an attempt to say, let's remember this war from the Vietnamese communist point of view. The book is arguing that there are many different ways to remember this war besides the American perspective. So let's talk about the American perspective or perspectives, but let's also talk about the Vietnamese of all sides, the Laotians, the Cambodians, who were very deeply affected by this war. And then lastly, again, the book is a meditation on why we remember, why we forget, what are the possibilities of reconciliation and forgetting after a very difficult, traumatic history that two or more sides may share.
Well, you came to the U.S. as a refugee in 1975, and after settling in a refugee camp, moved to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where you lived until 1978. And I'm from that part of Pennsylvania, and it was hard enough for me, an Italian-American. What was it like for you?
Actually, I think it was actually not too bad for me, because at that age, I was 4 to 7 years old. I was a child, so I wasn't really aware, for the most part, of the difficulties that my parents were going through to establish a life for us. They were not just immigrants. They were refugees. They had lost a lot of things materially and emotionally, and certainly their country and their identities. So I think for them it was a hard, hard time, and that was one of the reasons why they eventually left Pennsylvania to go to San Jose, California, where it would be a more hospitable environment. But as a child, for the most part, I had a very pleasant time just being a child. And I think my parents were able to create that space for me. But in returning as an adult some 25 years later and seeing what Harrisburg looked like through adult eyes and the neighborhoods that I lived in, which were lower middle class and very poor neighborhoods, I realized that I was very fortunate not to have grown up there.
So, okay, as you said, your family moved to San Jose, and they opened one of the first Vietnamese grocery stores, which you write about in your story, War Years, that's in the collection. I have to say, War Years has to be one of my favorite stories of all time. I was knocked out. It knocked me out. It was so I guess the climax of the story was so emotional. Can you talk a little bit about writing that story and bring us into that?
War Years is the only autobiographical piece of fiction I've ever written, and it's about a family in San Jose where the parents run a Vietnamese grocery store on Santa Clara Street, which is the main street, downtown street, and that is exactly what happened to my parents, and I've changed some of the details and exaggerated the characters, but many of the incidents in that story really happened to my family. And the crux of the story is that they're trying to make a living. And one day, this woman named Mrs. Hua comes into their store, and she's an anti-communist organizer, and she basically blackmails, or tries to blackmail, the store owners into giving her money to fight the communist side. And from the perspective of the store owners, especially the mother of the narrator, this is completely unacceptable because it's a tremendous struggle to make any kind of money. And even though they also are anti-communists, they believe that the war is over. So underneath the story of the refugees trying to make a living, there's another story about when a war is finally finished. And growing up in that community in San Jose, I was deeply aware of the fact that even though the war was technically over in 1975, for almost all of the Vietnamese refugees who had come over as adults, the war wasn't done. They were still emotionally affected by that war, and they carried the legacy, the trauma of that war with them into their everyday lives and interactions with each other.
That story has so many visceral details, so many specific telling details, and I didn't realize it was really the only autobiographical story you've written. How did you remember all of that? I mean, down to, Mrs. Hoa's roots, her gray roots coming in, or, her room in the house with the uniforms and how they looked.
Well, interestingly, all those details I made up because this is why I was a character I never met personally. But the details of the store, the market where the family is making a living, with rice stacked in 50-pound sacks and flypaper strips with dead flies encrusted on them hanging from the ceiling, and the various kinds of fruits and vegetables and all that, and the odor that they produced, that was the store that we lived in. And I recreate, you know, other scenes of life, such as the house that we lived in two doors down from the freeway entrance on South 10th Street. But in the case of Mrs. Hua, what happened there was that I think I heard my mother tell me once, yeah, there are these people who are asking for money for this anti-communist cause. And I certainly saw that happening in Vietnamese community events like the Debt Festival. But the details of her life, like what she looked like in this very crowded apartment, this very crowded house that she lives in with eight or nine other people, and the garage has been converted into a tailoring shop. I mean, I saw those kinds of things in San Jose, where people would convert their homes into businesses, and I knew that multiple families were living in these places trying to make a living. So it wasn't too hard to try to imagine how confined those houses must be and how desperate the working conditions must be for the people who lived in those homes.
At what point in writing The Refugees or putting these stories together, at what point did this story come about?
The story was challenging to write because I don't like writing about myself autobiographically. And, you know, all of the short stories I've written and The Sympathizer have done my best to try to create characters that are rather distant from me personally. So the process of writing the story was challenging because I had to adopt a first-person narrator that was quite intimate with me. And I had to, while I was doing that, I also had to try to get enough distance in order to write a story that made sense. It couldn't simply be a catalog of everything that happened in my family. I had to pick and choose the details and arrange them in a certain way so that the narrative would be shapely for the reader and that the climax would make sense. And so while many of the things in that story actually happened, it was the introduction of Mrs. Hua, which I made up, that I was able to give the story shape. And, you know, the final confrontation between the mother and Mrs. Hua, the revelation of the white roots that we see in her scalp, those were things that it took quite a while for me to try to figure out and insert into the story to give it the proper narrative.
So it sounds like you revise and revise and revise.
Writing short stories is extremely difficult, at least for me. You know, anybody who reads The Refugees can probably read that book in a few hours, in a day at the most. But it took me like 17 years, 1997 to 2014, and three more years to see it published. And stories typically took at least 10 to 20 drafts to write because they did require a lot of polishing, a lot of reshaping, a lot of cutting. The challenge for me in writing short stories, unlike in writing a novel, is that I have a lot to say, but in a short story, you have to say less. You have to say more with less, and that was not a natural inclination for me. And the story that really typifies that is the opening story, Black Eyed Women, which I started in 1997. I finished in 2014. That story took somewhere around 50 or more drafts to accomplish. It was a really, really difficult experience.
I'm glad to hear you're a reviser. Very glad.
Well, I think all writers are revisers.
Well, you know, although some writers really want it to happen fast and want to send their work out fast and get published fast, and sometimes too fast.
Well, that was something I had to learn. Certainly when you're young, or when I was young, I had ambitions that I could sit down and write and then I'd be famous. And that's naive, and it's also potentially very dangerous, because if that had actually happened, I wasn't that talented, basically. It took me a while to discover that I was not that talented. But if I was that talented and I did simply just write very easily and fame would have come to me quickly, it probably would have made me into a very messed up person at a young age. But instead, because I wasn't that talented, I had to take decades to learn how to write. And not only was that an important thing for me as a writer in a technical sense, but it was important for me as a writer in an emotional sense, in the sense that it taught me humility in the face of writing and my own ego. And so by the time The Sympathizer came about and the book got all this success and everything, I was able to handle it. And it was very nice to get all these awards and recognition, but I was mature enough by that time that I hopefully didn't change me in a fundamental way as a writer or as a human being. And so in that sense, it was a blessing in disguise to be a writer who had to learn the craft and had to struggle with revision and with acquiring all the abilities necessary to write.
Where did you learn to write like this? Because it sounds like writing wasn't your first choice. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it sounds like you put in the years, but how did you learn to write like this? I mean, you have such a grasp over fiction and nonfiction, and it's kind of unusual. I think most writers excel in one or the other.
Well, I think writing was always a first choice. That's certainly what I wanted to do as a child, as a teenager, when I went to school and college. But what happened to me in college was that I was distracted by becoming a critic, by becoming a scholar, and being very politically active. And those things were easier to do than writing fiction. And so when I graduated from college, I went to get a doctorate in English instead of going into a creative writing program. And at the same time, I hadn't given up on creative writing. I took a few creative writing workshops and discovered I hated creative writing workshops and decided that while writing fiction was still really important to me, I wasn't going to do it through school. I was going to learn the craft myself. And that's partially what took a long time. Something like 20 years to learn how to be a fiction writer, because I was also engaging in another profession as a scholar and as a teacher, and so I could only write on the side. There's no secret to what happened. It was really simply writing the stories of the refugees over 17 years taught me how to be a writer in a very slow and tortuous way. And what happened was really mysterious. I can't really account for it. You know, I just kept working at it long enough and was able to, you know, write these stories well enough to get them published in various venues. But the real breakthrough was when my agent told me the short story collection is good, but if you want to be published in New York, you have to write a novel. I said, fine. So I sat down to write The Sympathizer, and even though I'd never written a novel before, all that experience in writing the short stories had prepared me so that it felt like I was breaking through a wall and discovering my natural form in The Sympathizer, which is why one of the reasons why it only took a couple of years to write that book. So I think of that moment in The Karate Kid where Ralph Macchio is being forced to, you know, wax on and wax mm-hmm. off, do these mm-hmm. seemingly pointless chores, and he's really upset by that until he discovers that the whole point of that is to get him ready to be the Karate Kid. And I thought that was what had happened to me in writing the short stories.
Interesting. I think on that note, we're going to take a short break, give you a moment to take a sip of water, and we'll be right back. So stay with us. We'll be back with more Viet Thanh Nguyen in just a minute. Don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just a thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart, I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. Ooh. Oh, honey, it's been such a long time. Looks like I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And this show should be joining the podcasts that are up on our site at penonfire.com. If you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing when it is podcast, you will receive notification of that. And I've been with Viet Thanh Nguyen. His books are The Sympathizer, Nothing Ever Dies, and The Refugees. And he's going to be here at UCI on January 25th and again on February 3rd. So check out the UCI website for more info or write to me at penonfire.com. Next week, we have a speaker series event. You can also find info on that on the website. Let's bring him back on. Hi, Viet.
Hi, Barbara.
So before we took a break, you said, you know, it took a long time to learn how to write, but you hated writing workshops. And so I'm wondering if you ever considered an MFA program.
Well, I did. You know, when I was graduating from college, I had to make a choice between whether I wanted to apply for law school, writing programs, or English doctoral programs. And I just did an assessment of myself about where most of my talents or abilities lay at that point, and it was, you know, pretty clear that I could get into a top English doctoral program, but not a top MFA writing program. And I was a model minority. I was only going to go to the very best graduate programs I could get myself into. So that was just a rational decision that I made. And maybe I would have learned how to write short stories faster if I had gone through the MFA program. But I don't have any regrets about that, because I think that the other path that I chose, to become a scholar and to be very deeply immersed in the scholarly tradition, produced me as a very different kind of writer than almost everybody else, than most people who have gone through an MFA program, because I bring everything I know from criticism, scholarship, and theory into the writing of fiction. And I think, especially in the case of The Sympathizer, that's produced a very different kind of book.
Interesting. Yeah, great answer. I want to talk more about your stories. And another one that knocked me out was The Americans. And the change at the very end was, you know, it was so masterful. And I'd love to hear you talk about The Americans and how that story came about.
In writing The Refugees, the first ambition was to write about Vietnamese people of all backgrounds. And then the second ambition was also to talk about them in relationship to people who were not Vietnamese. And this is what happens in The Americans. And it's a story that's not from a Vietnamese point of view. It's from an American gentleman's point of view. And he's older, and he's a veteran, and he used to be a B-52 bomber pilot, and he's also black, although that's only mentioned very briefly once. But that fact really shapes the entire story. And in The Americans, the story is that he finally returns to Vietnam, a country that he bombed some 40 years later with his Japanese wife, and they're there to visit their daughter, who is now in Vietnam teaching English to Vietnamese children. And it's a story about confronting the past, both this pilot being finally forced to think about the implications of what might have happened during his bombing runs, and then also confronting his daughter and their very fraught and difficult emotional relationship as well.
What about I'd Love You to Want Me? Will you talk a bit about that story?
I'd Love You to Want Me is about an aging Vietnamese-American couple in Orange County, and they're on the brink of a happy retirement when the husband begins to descend into dementia, into Alzheimer's, and starts calling his wife by another woman's name. And she is unsure of whether this is simply a sign of dementia or whether this is some secret from his past that's emerging. And so I wrote that story because I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to write about Alzheimer's. I'm also very deeply interested in themes of memory and forgetting, and this allowed me to talk about those themes at a very personal level for these two characters. And I'm also fascinated by aging and by older people. We're all going to end up in this situation, most of us who make it that far. And it was an exercise in imagination and in empathy. So even though all the stories involve Vietnamese people in one way or another, most of these people are not like me. You know, they're older than me, or they're from different backgrounds, or they're different genders or sexual orientations and so on. And so each of those stories also required me to exercise imagination and empathy. And that's what I try to do in all these stories, is to get away from myself and to see the world through the perspectives of people who are rather different from me, despite sharing this common ethnic or national heritage.
Will you read from The Refugees?
I'm going to read the first paragraph of the book, which is from the story Black-Eyed Women.
Okay.
Fame, which strikes someone, usually the kind that healthy-minded people would not wish upon themselves, such as being kidnapped and kept prisoner for years, humiliated in a sex scandal, or surviving something typically fatal. These survivors needed someone to help write their memoirs, and their agents might eventually come across me. "At least your name's not on anything," my mother once said, when I mentioned that I would not mind being thanked in the acknowledgments. She said, "Let me tell you a story." It would be the first time I heard this story, but not the last. "In our homeland," she went on, "there was a reporter who said the government tortured the people in prison. So the government does to him exactly what he said they did to others. They send him away, and no one ever sees him again. That's what happens to writers who put their names on things."
I love that. And I love that it's a story about ghosts, and it's a story about a ghostwriter. How did this story come about?
Well, it was a very difficult story to write because the original premise of this story was about two lesbians, and they're in a relationship. And then one day, the ghost from the past shows up, the former lover of one of these women who did not make it out of Vietnam but died on the boat trip out of it. And that was a very complicated story because it involved a romantic love triangle, it involved ghosts, it involved lesbians, and I could not figure out how to make it work. And that's why it took over 50 drafts, because I'm a very plot-oriented writer. I wanted to make the plot function, and it wasn't. And the only way I could figure out how to solve it was to add more plot to it. So it just kept growing, growing, and growing, getting more and more complicated. Until finally, I put it aside, I wrote The Sympathizer, and then when I was finished, I came back to this story in 2014, and I decided, finally, that I understood that less is more. And so I threw out most of the story and began only with the premise of a woman who is visited by the ghost of not a lover, but her brother, who hadn't made it out of Vietnam, and the other part of the triangle is their mother. Now, mother believes in ghosts. The daughter, the narrator, the ghostwriter, despite her occupation, doesn't believe in ghosts, and she's forced to confront literally her past in the form of this ghost. And the origins of that idea are that for Vietnamese people, many of us, not me personally, but many of us do believe in ghosts, both scary ghosts, but also benevolent ghosts, ghosts who make the final visit after their death in order to say goodbye to their loved ones. And that's the kind of ghost this story is about. It's not a horror story. It's actually a love story among family members involving return of a ghost.
I love that you let stories sit. Again, you know, you've talked about this earlier, but it seems that the longer you let a piece sit, the more it comes into focus for you, the writer.
I think inevitably that's true. You gain perspective on what you've written, what you've struggled with. And so in this story, you know, I probably wrote 20 or 30 drafts in a year or two, and I was simply too close to that story. And then I really needed to just sort of not think about it for a decade or however many years I let life fallow. And again, when you're a young writer, I would not have wanted to hear this. You know, as a young writer, I could barely imagine a year or two, much less 10 years or 20 years. And if someone had told me it would take me 20 years to write a short story collection, I would have probably not written that short story collection. And one of the most important skills that a writer can acquire is patience, the ability to wait and to come back, and to be able to be one's own editor. That's partially what distance and time allows you to do, is to look at your story not from the perspective of the writer that you are, but from the perspective of the editor that you need to be, and to gain some kind of objective distance from what has taken such an emotional and aesthetic toll on you.
Do you have readers for your work during this time?
My most reliable reader is my wife. Unfortunately for her, she's read everything, and not just the final polished version, but everything in its, you know, creaky drafts. And it's, you know, if you could just see what these stories looked like when I was writing them in the 1990s, you would feel tremendous pity for her, because they were awful. You know, so she's been very, very important to me. And then I've had occasional readers here and there. And I have, you know, one important reader for The Synthesizer, who is a friend of mine who's a playwright. But for the most part, I don't have writing groups. You know, I don't have writing groups that I can rely on. I don't have a writing network that I can rely on. And so I've learned how to be self-sufficient as a writer. And that's possibly another reason it took me so long to write these short stories.
How did you arrange the stories in the collection?
There's a narrative in the arrangement of the stories. So Black Eyed Women is about a Vietnamese-American writer and the visitation of the past upon her through this ghost. And Fatherland, the last story, is about a young Vietnamese-American woman who returns to Vietnam to meet her half-sister, who's Vietnamese, and the story is told from that half-sister's perspective. So there's an arc in the story collection from arriving to the United States as refugees, and then the struggle with being a refugee in this country and building a life here, and then finally the return to Vietnam and the perspective of the Vietnamese people in Vietnam as they look at these Vietnamese Americans coming back.
Interesting. I'm curious, because you write so well in different genres, will you talk a bit about finding the context for your ideas? I mean, do you know when you have an idea if it's a novel, a short story, an essay, a narrative for a nonfiction book? You know, how does that happen for you?
I think in writing the short stories, I had a hard time figuring out what idea was good for a short story and what idea might be good for a novel. You know, so many of the short stories in The Refugees could potentially, you know, if I expanded them, they could become novels, for example, or short novels. And at the same time, because many of those ideas could be that complicated, it was hard then to cut them down to the level of a short story. But after I was done writing the refugees and I was asked by my agent to write a novel, the first thing that came to mind was spy novel. And I had a plot that I was really, you know, I was able to come up with that plot fairly quickly. So I think after a protracted struggle with writing, it became a lot easier for me to figure out, you know, what kind of a story might emerge from an idea. And it became a lot easier for me to figure out how to work quickly with some concepts. So by now, it's actually very easy for me to write, you know, book reviews and short essays and op-eds that are 1,000 or 2,000 words long. I can crank those out in a few hours. And maybe it might be the case that if I were to return to the short story form, I could write short stories more easily now, but I have no idea, because I don't ever want to write another short story again after the experience I went through with with the refugees. But it seems to me that with novels, I'm much more confident about that. I'm writing the sequel to The Sympathizer right now. It fills me with, you know, great excitement and not as much dread as I would have for writing short stories, especially because I have these ideas and I think I know how to translate them into the form of a novel and its chapters and its organization, and all of that comes about from having gone through the experience of writing a novel.
So regarding the sequel, do you outline? Do you have sort of the plot points already in your mind, or the major conflicts? I mean, how does that go for you in writing a novel?
Well, in writing the short stories, I would just have an idea, and then I'd jump into writing the story and not have no clue where I was going. And that's partially why it would take me so long to write each of these stories. I had to figure out all the different elements as I went along. So when it came time to writing The Sympathizer, I thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to have a very clear plan. And so I came up with a 2-page synopsis for the novel. And that synopsis was fairly accurate up until the last third of the book. But even in writing that synopsis, I knew that the conclusion that I had come up with was not really what I wanted to write, or I had a target that I would aim for. And I hoped that as I wrote the novel, I would understand what the ending was, and that's pretty much exactly what happened. So having that outline was really crucial, because I did map out the general arc of the plot, the major characters, where the major turns of the plot would be, the climax, and so on. And that was really crucial, because the novel was also supposed to function as a thriller and a spy novel, and the plot had to make sense. And in writing The Committed, I just took that concept of plotting and really exaggerated it, because instead of a 2-page synopsis, I have a 20-page synopsis and 50 pages of single-spaced notes. And partially the reason why I have all that information is that while I was writing Nothing Ever Dies, I was taking all these notes about what I thought might be in The Committed. And whereas with The Sympathizer, I had a very skeletal plot to work from, and I filled in the details as I went along, in The Committed, I had the opposite opportunity or problem, which is I probably have too much information in this 25-page synopsis, and as I write the novel, I probably have to take out ideas as I go along.
Interesting. Well, you know, as well as being a writer, you're an active professor, and you're all over the place speaking and taking part in conferences. So do you have a really regimented writing schedule? How do you get all this writing done?
Well, The Sympathizer I wrote in 2 years, and I was very lucky. I had a fellowship. Actually, a fellowship was to write Nothing Ever Dies, and I decided, well, I'm not going to do that. I'll use this fellowship to write my novel instead. And then I had sabbatical time as well. So during that time, I wrote 4 hours a day, and I went to the gym every day. And the hour that I spent running on the treadmill at the gym was actually really crucial to the writing process, because that's where I figured out what I was going to write the next day. And so that was a very magical time for 2 years, and maybe I'll get that time again. But the reality of it is that what my writing schedule really looks like is what I did for most of the time I was an academic, which was to try to find an hour here, 2 hours there, a few days out of the week, and when I wasn't writing or teaching, when I wasn't writing scholarship or teaching, and fill in and do my fiction writing in the cracks of time, and then spend much more time in the summers. And that's pretty much been the experience after The Sympathizer, is that my writing schedule is, you know, 4 or 5 days out of the week when I'm not teaching, or doing administrative work, then I'll find a couple hours a day to write 1,000 words. And that's fairly frustrating because I want to spend more time. But as long as I can get those couple of hours a day in, then I'm a reasonably nice human being to the people around me.
We have a few minutes left with Viet Thanh Nguyen. His books are The Refugees and Nothing Ever Dies, Vietnam and the Memory of War, and The Sympathizer. Can you talk a little bit about how to write yourself out of something that's not working? Have you had that experience in either writing, you know, The Sympathizer, Nothing Ever Dies, or The Refugees, where you just don't know what to do?
Well, in the case of The Refugees, the clear example is Black-Eyed Women. And I think that I wrote myself into a corner that I couldn't get out of after 20 or 30 drafts, and I couldn't see my way out of the complications of the plot. And again, being able to put aside the project for enough time so that I could return to it and make some kind of assessment of it was really crucial. And what that means is that my way of dealing with complications in my writing is always to have multiple writing projects. So I could put aside Black-Eyed Women and then turn to another short story, or I'm writing The Sympathizer, and at the same time that I'm writing The Sympathizer, I'm also thinking about Nothing Ever Dies for in the back of my mind, so that when I finish The Sympathizer, I can turn immediately to Nothing Ever Dies. So that's, for me, a really crucial part of the writing process. There's no lag time. There's never a time when I'm not working on a project. So even after I finish writing a book, I don't stop and say, I'm going to take a 2-week vacation. Instead, I turn to the next book. And because I've been thinking about it and taking notes, I can immediately jump into that project. So I think having alternatives helps to avoid getting trapped, because if you have no other alternative, you're only writing one project, there's nowhere else to go if you stop writing. And I think I would feel very guilty if I stopped writing and that story that I couldn't get myself around would just obsess me and haunt me. And so it's nice to be able to have something else to do besides just the one writing project.
So I'm guessing that during those times you keep social media and other time sucks at bay.
Well, you know, after the winning the Pulitzer, it was obviously great, but the terrible thing about it was that for 8 months I didn't get any fiction writing done, and that was because I was responding to all of these requests for my time for interviews or op-eds, and I was doing it to myself too. It was a very distracting time, and it was really hard for me to focus on writing fiction. And so I turned to writing op-eds and also to social media. I was very active for 8 months, you know, cultivating my Twitter feed and my Facebook profiles and all that kind of stuff. And that is a kind of writing. It was just very distracting kind of writing, but it kept me engaged with people, and it made me think that I was still doing something. And there is some utility to that, because I was using this platform of having won the Pulitzer to make certain kinds of, you know, political and social points to a larger audience who might not be reading my fiction. But it is quite a relief now to tone that down and to get back to writing the sequel to The Sympathizer, which I've been able to do over the last few weeks.
Can't wait to read that. And in closing, I wonder if you have any last words or any words of wisdom for the fiction writers listening.
Patience. I think that's a very hard thing to learn, because again, when you're younger, I think it's hard to be patient. You're naturally impatient. You want to move forward and get ahead. And I think writing is a long game. For most of us, unless you're incredibly talented, writing is something that you have to live with and cultivate, and you have to learn how to deal with rejection, and probably even worse than rejection, you have to deal with obscurity. You have to deal with people not caring about what you're doing, and you have to learn how to be patient in order to live with yourself, to watch yourself grow and to, you know, acquire wisdom, and that it takes age and experience. And I think that's actually very crucial for writing. Writing is not simply a technical exercise. I mean, learning how to do different technical things in writing is obviously crucial, but I see a lot of young writers, and they can do that. They can write stories but they don't have wisdom or maturity. And that means that there's a whole layer that's missing to their writing. And that's something that you're going to acquire through time.
Mm. Viet Thanh Nguyen, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Barbara. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. That was Viet Thanh Nguyen. His books are The Refugees, Nothing Ever Dies, and The Sympathizer. And if you haven't read any of them yet, it's time. It's really time. And these stories really knocked me out. As I've said, they're one of them, The Warriors, is really on my list now of my favorite stories of all time. Anyway, we'll be back next week. If you want to know more, please visit penonfire.com, and I'll see you soon. Stay in the chair.